Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, June 25th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho Republican State Convention delegate who proposed platform plank says he really wants to stop taxpayer money going to higher education, not just Idaho launch. Idaho Democratic Party Chair Lauren Nekochia discusses the state of education in Idaho and other issues in exclusive KRFP interview. Washington Democrats narrowly vote against resolution to block nuclear power at their state convention in Bremerton. And Montana Group gathers more than enough signatures to get state constitutional amendment on November ballot protecting reproductive freedom. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. At their state convention at North Idaho College in Coeur d'Alene, June 15th, Idaho Republican delegates approved new language to a platform plank on career education that says Republicans, quote, do not support using taxpayer funding for programs beyond high school. The Idaho Press reported shortly after the convention, some Republican officials who attended the closed-door platform session, such as State Superintendent of Public Instruction Debbie Critchfield, thought the platform plank was intended to oppose Idaho Launch, which Republican Governor Brad Little promoted and which the legislature narrowly approved, giving graduating high school seniors $8,000 scholarships if they pursue careers that a state board considers in demand. The Idaho Education News reports in an analysis piece, since the press was forbidden to attend the platform deliberation meeting, it was difficult to tell what delegates thought they were voting on, although delegate and Republican State Senator Kevin Cook of Idaho Falls told the Idaho Press he believed the platform plank, as amended, was meant to oppose the Idaho Launch program. But the delegate who proposed the change to the platform, Scott Tillement of Caldwell, told the Idaho Education News, quote, launch is only the most egregious example of taxpayers being forced to fund post-secondary schooling. I believe the government should not be involved in higher education at all. I do believe that continuing education is important, but not with taxpayer money. The individual should be making that decision. There are many private organizations, charities, and foundations that commit millions of dollars in scholarships. Why do we need to take money from hardworking taxpayers on top of that? The state spends more than $500 million on higher education every year, including $365 million for the state's four-year colleges, $64 million for community colleges, $25 million for opportunity scholarships, and $70.8 million in the recently approved Idaho Launch program. Because of that, defunding higher ed would effectively drive a stake in the heart of higher education in the state. Delegates offered an amendment to the platform plank to make the sentence about not supporting taxpayer money going to programs beyond high school to specifically only refer to Idaho Launch, which the right-wing Republicans oppose, despite the fact it was a major initiative of Republican Governor Brad Little. The platform committee voted that down. State Superintendent of Public Instruction Debbie Critchfield, a Republican, was allowed to observe the platform committee debate but not take part because she was not a platform committee member. Critchfield told the Idaho Education News, I didn't walk away from that discussion and that vote throwing my hands up in the air and saying Republicans don't care about education. The platform committee added the language to a previous year's platform plank that said, we strongly support professional, technical, and continuing education programs that provide career readiness and college preparation. The amendment adds that Republicans, quote, do not support using taxpayer funding for programs beyond high school. Critchfield said, I was above the area where the delegates were seated and people during it looking at me kind of like, what is this? Does this mean what I think it means? If Idaho defunded higher education, Critchfield said, it would force career technical training and workforce development programs to fall under the K-12 budget. Governor Brad Little and Lieutenant Governor Scott Bedke issued statements last week saying the position written in the Republican platform does not reflect the opinions of the vast majority of Republicans in Idaho. Little wrote, "My commitment to strengthening the economy by training the next generation does not end at high school graduation. The state has helped generations of Idahoans receive their post-high school college education, including my children and me." Lieutenant Governor Bedke wrote, "Our state colleges, universities, and technical education programs are more than schools. They are investments in the future prosperity of the Gem State. And if we want our kids to choose to stay in Idaho, we cannot take away the state's support for these educational opportunities. Otherwise, they will leave and look for them elsewhere." During the Idaho Democratic State Convention this past weekend, I got a chance to speak to State Democratic Party Chair Lauren Necochea, who is also a state representative from Boise. Necochea spoke about education in Idaho and a number of other issues. Here's that interview.
I sort of want to start with like the big question, which I think is like almost existential for the whole planet. How are Democrats responding to the tendencies these days for people to believe things without evidence? I'm, you know, talking about fake news, where there's a situation where on the internet you can't tell what's fake news anymore. And I think this goes to the issues of education that Democrats are talking about. So maybe we could just start with that big overall question: is what is going on now with people being gaslighted?
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge challenge with all of this. You know, the deep fakes, the you know, anything can be doctored these days. And we took one small step. This legislature, my Democratic colleague, Representative Rubel, brought legislation to say that if you, you know, create a deep fake political ad, you need at least to disclose on there somewhere that this is not real. This person didn't really say the words that you're, you know, making them say, because we need protection from that false information, because people can just lie and fabricate things to get power and then do something completely contrary to what they've promised, or they could try to beat out their challenger by lying. And but the technology today just makes it all the scarier.
Yeah, and that's probably not really enough, because it goes down. We have a situation in Florida and even Idaho. You can't teach about social justice. Teachers are scared to teach the truth about all sorts of issues.
Yeah. We have to protect our ability to teach about, you know, history, current public affairs accurately, and then let students use their critical thinking to make judgments. But when we can't censor our teachers, and, you know, in Idaho, we've been able to beat back some of the worst legislative proposals that would really scare teachers about teaching, you know, just the facts about history and what's happened in our country.
Okay. I want to talk about how Democrats have pushed back during the legislature, because on our radio station, we cover the debates in the committees and on the floor. And, yeah, of course, we'll put the conservative Republican side on, because people need to hear sometimes how outlandish some of those things are. But we'll also put on you and Elena and other members of the legislature. And I was thinking about one speech that you gave on the House floor back in 2022 about this abortion bill, making it so that people can sue abortion doctors if they perform an abortion, including like the grandmothers, all the family members of both the person who had the abortion and the father.
Yeah.
And if the father's a rapist, there's a cutout in that law, but not for the family. You went over that wonderfully, but people didn't listen. I mean, that passed, was it party line?
I think that one was essentially party line. Yeah, the idea that a rapist family member could sue a doctor for a cash reward is unbelievable. And it was a really interesting debate because I think the Republicans were absolutely ashamed of what they were voting for. They didn't want to stand up and debate in favor of it. They wanted the debate to just end. But there's also a thing that happens where, you know, kind of their brains turn off when it comes to an abortion bill because the political pressure is so strong and they've become so dependent on the anti-abortion hardliners, giving them their money and their endorsement in their campaigns, that they're just totally afraid of going against the grain. And so they cater to the anti-abortion hardliners every time. And if the anti-abortion hardliners want a bill that threatens cash rewards for rapist family members or the patient's extended family, it could have been an aunt by marriage, you know, through people who have no business threatening a lawsuit and deciding what kind of medical care you can get or not.
And from what I remember, Governor Little signed that, and he's also signed a number of other almost like overlapping anti-abortion laws. And I was wondering if you could maybe parse out a little bit where we stand. It seems like the trigger law is the main one, 5 years in prison for doctors, and the other ones that maybe passed maybe don't even take effect or even moot because doctors aren't going to do abortions, you know, under those situations.
That's right. We've had years of, you know, the anti-abortion hardliner lobby just kind of throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks. So we saw the bounty law get passed as kind of an idea of what can we do now while Roe v. Wade is still protecting reproductive freedoms nationally. And then the trigger law was ready to go, threatening those prison sentences for doctors, nurses, any healthcare provider that provides abortion care. So as soon as Roe v. Wade was struck by the extreme conservative Supreme Court, just overnight. I think it took about 30 days. Our AG at the time gave us about 30 days for the law to take effect. And then just the immediate negative consequences started with, you know, 22% of our OB-GYNs left the state within 18 months of the law taking effect. More than half of our maternal and fetal medicine specialists, these are the doctors you need to see when you've got a pregnancy complication, when you really need that expertise to help you. Those, you know, 55% of them have left the state.
And there was only a very few to begin with.
We had 9 to begin with, and 5 have left the state.
And we aren't able to recruit more back either.
It's enormously difficult to recruit anyone working in maternal care to our state right now.
So is this bounty law a trigger law, or it actually went into effect before the Supreme Court overturned it? It was 22 when they...
Yeah, so it's kind of on the books, but it's never really been used.
But suppose the Supreme Court this week says, oh, well, you have to treat women with an abortion to save their health, which we don't know what's going to happen this week. That means the doctor performs an abortion to save the health of a mother, but then the trigger law might still apply? Is there an exception in that? I forget.
Those things kind of work together. It's the, you know, so after, you know, the trigger bill went into effect, and the only exception in it is to prevent the death of the woman, of the patient. And so when you have, you know, and you can even have a non-viable pregnancy, but there's still, you know, some sort of cardiac activity in the fetus, that the patient is being forced to carry that pregnancy. And even if she gets, say, an infection that's starting to threaten her health, and she goes to an ER where normally our EMTALA protections. EMTALA is a federal law signed into law by Ronald Reagan that says if you show up at an ER with kind of an emergency medical condition, they have to stabilize you. They have to provide the standard of care that stabilizes you. So up until, you know, January, we had a lower court in Idaho say this EMTALA protection applies to a patient who goes into the ER with a pregnancy complication that requires abortion care, so that the health doesn't get worse. You can't discharge, you know, I mean, you I guess it would be legal, but what they're saying is, and doctors want to provide this care so that they don't have to wait until a patient becomes absolutely septic and is on death's door, and then maybe they need a hysterectomy and can't ever have a child again because they had the doctors had to let the infection get worse and worse and worse because the patient wasn't yet at death's door. So in my mind, the lower court ruling that meant we always had these EMTALA protections for medical emergencies was very narrow, and only if you go show up at an ER, if you show up at the clinic, doesn't apply, you still can't get the care you need. Even in an emergency, you have to go to a physical emergency room. These protections were, I thought they were just a lifeline for the Republicans who passed atrocious legislation. You would have thought the Republicans would have said, of course people should get care in a medical emergency. No, what they immediately did was appeal that decision because they want to have the right to deny those women care in emergencies. They appealed it, but it took, a law didn't take effect until January when the U.S. Supreme Court said, yeah, we'll go ahead and let this case take effect. The Idaho Republicans are appealing the lower court's decision. We're going to let it take effect until we hear the case. They heard the case in April, and now we're waiting for the decision, hopefully come next week. And hopefully it's a decision that will save lives and save the future fertility of women who are being airlifted out of state every 2 weeks, at least. That's what we know our largest health system is seeing, just so they can get that emergency care. And who pays for that? You know, who pays for that life flight is a question that Republicans aren't asking and don't care about. We've got OB-GYNs advising their pregnant patients to get Medevac insurance so that if they need to be life flighted out, it will be covered, which is just unconscionable that in this country, in this day, with all of the modern advances in healthcare, that patients are being airlifted.
Okay. I just want to move on to a little bit to, how Democrats can successfully get elected to the legislature this year. Somebody commented from the stage, it might have been you, that the Democratic Party seems more united now on the issues. And despite the fact that this platform and resolution discussion went on for 2 hours, it seemed like it was mainly over very, very minor, even grammatical things about the platform. I remember a number of years ago, there were like conservative Idaho Democrats who are totally against abortion, you know, and that's doesn't seem to be. What are your thoughts about the unity of the party and I guess the reasons would be the right-wing onslaught, but yeah.
The stakes are too high for us to fight amongst ourselves is, I think, the simple thing. You know, we came out today with a platform and resolutions that are all about improving the lives of Idahoans, making sure they can get good jobs with good wages, they can get the skills they need to get into those in-demand careers. We're talking about how do we make sure childcare is affordable for families? How do we make sure that, middle-class families can afford a home? We all want to, see how we can work together to solve problems and make life better. And that's a positive conversation to have. when you compare it to the Republican Party platform is like a long list of ways they want to oppress us. You know, they want to take away, now they're attacking and want to criminalize the practices that make in vitro fertilization possible. I mean, you just can't imagine the new oppressive thing that they're going to come after us with. They want to totally defund higher education. It's no longer about just taking away the launch scholarships that are going to make 10,000 high school seniors able to go to nursing school or go to a welding program or get trained for some other in-demand career. They want to defund Idaho State University, University of Idaho, our community colleges, Boise State University, all of our colleges, Lewis and Clark State College, all of our colleges and universities, and it's just shocking.
Eventually K-12, although they didn't mention that in the Republican platform, but they did seem to be against all higher ed funding.
One way they want to defund K-12 is to send a lot of money out the door in a costly voucher scheme to private and religious schools with zero accountability.
That was an interview with Idaho Democratic Party Chair Lauren Necochea, who was in Moscow this weekend for the Democratic State Convention held at the Bruce Pittman Center on the University of Idaho campus. Washington Democrats met at their state convention in Bellevue over the weekend, and delegates on Sunday voted on a number of resolutions, narrowly rejecting a resolution saying nuclear energy, quote, is not the solution to climate change. Another resolution that failed to pass said the state should not use funding for clean energy to support the construction of small modular nuclear reactors. The delegate votes on both resolutions were 373 against and 361 in favor. The spokesman review reported Dan Lewinsky told the delegates during debate, non-nuclear renewable energy does not generate enough electricity for Washington, and nuclear energy is a clean alternative. Roxanne Thayer spoke to delegates saying solar energy has great potential in the state, and the state should focus on that rather than nuclear energy. Thayer spoke about the Biden administration's Justice 40 policy that says 40% of benefits of some of the environmental, housing, and other federal investments should go to disadvantaged communities that have been disproportionately harmed by pollution. She said close to one quarter of U.S. generating capacity is now from large and small solar. At this rate, solar will surpass natural gas capacity by 2026. There isn't time for nuclear. In addition to that, the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council recommendation on Justice 40, I'm quoting, must include taking bold action to sunset investment by 2030 in fossil fuels, plastics, dangerous chemicals, and nuclear energy to set requirements for 100% renewable electricity by 2030. Washington Democratic delegates at the convention also voted for platform resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and to stop all military aid to Israel.
Workers who help Washington State classrooms run are calling for higher wages. Known as classified staff, their jobs include administrative work, transportation, and custodial services. Unions representing workers, including the American Federation of Teachers of Washington and Washington Education Association, have launched a wage campaign to increase pay for these workers. Anitra Wise works with the Tacoma School District as a paraeducator, helping teachers in the classroom. She says her wages simply aren't enough.
We have to work two and three different jobs just to catch up with the cost of living, including housing, groceries, and things that we need to survive.
With Washington State school districts out for summer, classified staff members face another challenge, the suspension of their low wages. Wise says she's working at summer school this year.
We have to supplement that income somehow, and I really don't get a summer because I have to work just to supplement my income.
Wise says classified staff have many important jobs, including the work she does as a paraeducator in the classroom.
We're the glue that keep it together, do all the small jobs and the big jobs too, because without the team of paraeducators, the teachers would not be able to teach. And paraeducators are teachers also.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook. KRFP is also sponsored by
Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Washington has received designations that highlight the state's efforts to become more age and dementia friendly. Washington is the 12th state to join the AARP network of age-friendly states and communities. Susan Ingalls, Office Chief for the Unit on Aging for the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services, says the designation builds on work the state is already doing to support people of all ages.
Age-friendly communities consider goals that promote high quality of life, for each person, regardless of their age, allowing older people the opportunity to remain active in their community. So the designation begins a book of work that we're very excited to do.
Some cities in the state have already joined the AARP Age-Friendly Network, such as Puyallup, Renton, Seattle, Tacoma, and White Salmon. Some of the goals for age-friendly communities include ensuring people can age in place and building walkable communities to ensure people can maintain both their independence and connection with others. Washington is also joining U.S. Aging's Dementia-Friendly America Network. Ingalls says the state is already supporting people with dementia.
Developing more community opportunities for families living with dementia, things like zoo walks and cafes where people can come and not worry about being judged if their loved one behaves differently.
Family caregiving is another important area as the population ages. According to AARP statistics, the number of family caregivers available in Washington will decline from about 4.5 in 2030 to less than 3 in 2050. But Ingalls says the state has support in these areas as well, such as through respite and counseling to help people maintain these roles.
We have innovative programs, both state-funded and federally funded, where we are able to support family caregivers, regardless of income levels, with services that help those family caregivers be able to maintain their role.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Pullman City Council tonight will have a discussion item requested by council members DeLira and Fajerin on a ceasefire resolution. The resolution was provided by the Palouse Democratic Socialists of America and was discussed at the last Pullman City Council meeting. The agenda says this agenda item request was for discussion only and no final action will be taken. Also on the Pullman City Council agenda tonight, there will be a vote on amending the city's biennium budget for 2023 to 2024 regarding the ratification of a contract agreement with the International Association of Firefighters Local 1892 and subsequent compression to salaries as it affects the fire department chief and assistant chiefs. Also on the agenda, there's a resolution approving a 6-year capital improvement program for the city and another resolution approving a 6-year transportation improvement program for the city. There's also a scheduled vote on adopting a fee schedule for fire permits in accordance with Pullman City Code and a resolution establishing a small public works roster process to award public works contracts and a consulting service roster for architectural, engineering, and other professional services. There's another discussion item on the Pullman City Council agenda, which is a continued discussion regarding vacant commercial spaces. The Pullman City Council will meet at 7 p.m. tonight at City Hall.
A union formed to fight for the rights of Bozeman's lower-income residents is pushing for mandatory legal assistance for people facing eviction. Opponents say it's unfair to landlords. Bozeman Tenants United calls itself a multiracial, intergovernmental movement to win safe, dignified, and affordable housing for working-class renters. Director Benjamin Finnegan says rising rents and less availability is proving to be death by a thousand cuts for these renters, whom he says are forced to spend as much as half of their income on housing, if they can afford it at all. He calls evictions acts of violence and claims they're at the heart of Bozeman's housing crisis.
Where an eviction, in a lot of ways, is a death sentence. It means that you are out on the street with nowhere to go, possibly with kids. It means that you have a red stamp on your rental record, and it will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to find new housing.
Finnegan's working to get financial support from Bozeman to pay for legal representation for low-income households facing eviction. The State Landlords Association is among the groups pushing back on that idea, saying rent prices are simply driven by market conditions and supply and demand. Finnegan says Bozeman would join more than a dozen other towns and cities around the country that have instituted some form of legal assistance for people facing eviction. In Bozeman, Finnegan says at least 2/3 of residents are low-income renters, and as that number continues to grow, his group will push for the funding to pay for legal help.
fighting for approximately $670,000 per year in order to actually fund enough attorneys to give people full legal representation through eviction court filings, as well as illegal dangerous living conditions.
Finnegan says mandatory city-funded legal representation for low-income people has sharply reduced the eviction rate in other places across the country that have adopted it, including a dramatic drop in evictions in Kansas City. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
2 years to the day after the Dobbs decision, activists from Montanans Securing Reproductive Rights turned in nearly double the number of signatures needed yesterday to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot to protect abortion access. Organizers say they submitted 117,000 signatures to the Secretary of State's office in Helena. While the threshold for getting an initiative on the ballot is just over 60,000, as long as signature gatherers sign up 10% of the registered voters from 40 out of Montana's 100 House districts. Organizers say the number of signatures is the largest ever for a Montana ballot initiative. Planned Parenthood Advocates of Montana CEO Martha Fuller said, "Here in Montana, our rights are being targeted by extreme anti-abortion politicians who are trying every single trick in the book to rip away our freedom to make private medical decisions. With just over 2 months to gather the signatures, a fierce group of supporters and volunteers have shown us all that Montanans are ready to defend our reproductive rights." Abortion is legal in Montana, in part because the Montana Supreme Court found the right to abortion access falls under Montana's right to privacy under the state constitution. When the Trump Supreme Court made the Dobbs decision in June 2022, they hinged their decision on what they saw as a lack of a right to privacy on the federal level, a decision that opened the door to the removal of a number of important rights, including the right to access birth control. The initiative would amend the state constitution to, quote, expressly provide a right to make and carry out decisions about one's own pregnancy, including the right to abortion, unquote. The amendment would also prohibit the government from interfering with an abortion before a fetus is viable. Counties are expected to certify the signatures by Friday, July 19th, and the Secretary of State will have until Monday, August 22nd, to certify the statewide ballots and schedule Constitutional Amendment 128 for the November ballot. Organizers fought for months with Republican Attorney General Austin Knutson over ballot language and later over the process to move to the signature-gathering phase. According to the Daily Montanan, once signature-gatherers began their work, they faced intimidation and threats from a small and vocal group of anti-abortion activists. ACLU of Montana Executive Director Akilah Dearnos said, "Montanans have made it clear that they are sick and tired of anti-abortion extremists interfering with their private medical decisions, and so today we could not be more excited for where we are." Montanans for Reproductive Rights has raised $3 million for the campaign. A separate group, Montanans for Choice, has launched a billboard and digital ad campaign saying reproductive freedom is a Montana value. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Looking at the weather, increasing clouds, low 58 tonight, 20% chance of showers before 9 a.m. tomorrow. Otherwise, partly sunny, high 83, light and variable wind becoming west 10 to 15 in the morning with gusts up to 20. Mostly cloudy Wednesday night, low 51, west winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25. On Thursday, 30% chance of precipitation, a slight chance of showers, then a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Otherwise, partly sunny, high 68, west winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25. And currently 82 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP.org website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP with many options. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Flashpoints is up next, and Rude Awakening is on 7:30 to 9:30. Mostly a discussion show most weeks. And at 9:30, Brent Bentz in to play music for you, 9:30 to 11. At 11 o'clock, we've got Jeremy Scahill's podcast, Intercepted, on the air. So stay tuned for more information, entertainment, and music throughout your evening here at KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Hunga Dunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hunga Dunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers. At hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
KRFP supports progressive values, including multiculturalism and environmentalism.